plate a potential nugget.
Dan, would love to dive into your book on regret in a couple of minutes, but I'm curious about people's journeys in this podcast. And I was just looking at the body of work and the books you've written. You've written the books Free Agent Nation in 2001, Whole New Mind in 2006. Then you wrote a book in the Japanese comic format, which was interesting, Adventures of Johnny Bunko. Then you wrote a book on human motivation in 2011. And on selling, To Sell as Human in 2013. And then you wrote a book on the science of timing in 2018 and now Regret. Just connect the dots for us.
Oh, I don't know if the dots are connectable. I'm not sure the dots are even meant to be connected. Mm-hmm. If there's any connection, there's certainly, I know that you were at McKinsey, and so you're a skilled strategist. It's not as if I've ever had a broad strategy for the books that I want to write up on a whiteboard somewhere vetted by consultants. I'll give you my theory here, Deepak, which is that writing good books is really, really hard. It's a lot of work. It's really, really hard. And a lot of it, even though I like it in the abstract sense, sometimes day to day, it's a struggle. You're always doing battle. And so you have to pick things that you're deeply, 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 deeply interested in. And that's not most things. And so I just move to whatever I'm deeply interested in and write about that. And if the dots connect, great. If they don't connect, who cares?
Hmm. But off the various books, I was curious about the book in the Japanese art form. Tell us what's behind that. Yeah. That's not a usual choice.
So I'm very proud of that book, even though I think it sold fewer copies than any other of the books. So what I decided to do there was I wrote a career guide, but in the Japanese comic form manga. And what happened is that my family and I, we did a fellowship in Japan in 2007, where I studied the manga industry, and I wrote some things about that. Manga is just comics in Japan, but in Japan, comics are used in a much wider array of forms than certainly in the United States and probably India too. It's used for business books and cooking guides and relationship guides and so forth. And I thought that a business book, a career guide in manga would be a brilliant idea. And so I hired a manga artist and we wrote I think it's a pretty good book called The Adventures of Johnny Bunko, the last career guide you'll ever need, where this bumbling accountant named Johnny has a pair. One night he's working late. And he gets some food and he snaps open these chopsticks and he has this collection of chopsticks. And each time he snaps open the chopstick, this sprightly figure named Diana emerges and she gives him a lesson in how to have a satisfying career. So
fascinating.
I'm proud of that book. I also, but here we go in the annals of bad business judgment. Right when it came out, actually before it came out, a movie producer heard of it. Mm-hmm. And heard about it and said, okay, we want to option this to turn into an animated film. Mm-hmm. And they made an offer that was like a very, very low offer. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, that's like way too little money. And besides, we're going to get plenty of other offers. And we never got another one. So
Fair enough. Let's move to the current book. Dan, you call this a regret reclamation project. Talk to us a little bit about the origins of this book. How do you end up getting curious about regret?
Well, I think it was for a whole host of reasons. There's an old line in certainly in social science, but I think in other forms of science, which is that all research is me-search. And so for me, I think that was partly the case. I was at a point in my life where it was a weird point in my life where I had mileage behind me, which kind of surprised me. Mm-hmm. I mean, really surprised me. But then also had mileage ahead of me, I hope. And I was dealing with some of my own regrets and just thinking about them, not just pondering them and trying to make sense of them, not debilitated by them at all. And I found something interesting that when I very, very sheepishly mentioned them to people, very sheepishly, because nobody wants to talk about this. I found that people leaned in. They wanted to talk about it. They wanted to share their regret. And I got a kind of this kind of electric response that, again, going back to your initial question, for a writer is like a really good piece of data. It's like, whoa, wait a second. Here's a, like, I've had other topics where I bring it up, I have an idea and I bring it up and people just start fleeing the room, or they start, their eyes start glazing over. And this one was just the exact opposite. People were like, whoa, hey, and I thought that was really interesting. And I really wanted to make, I really wanted to make sense of it myself. The other thing, I guess, as a writer, maybe there is a little bit of dot connecting here, is that a lot of the books that I had written were a little bit more, they weren't as much about emotions, and I never really taken on writing about emotions. And that's obviously really important. And this emotion of regret ends up being a very important emotion. But to make a just to put a pin on it, to put a button on the end of it, is like, I can't imagine having written this book in my 30s. There's no way. But in my 50s, it felt almost inevitable.
Got it. Actually, one of the things I wanted to, it struck me, in this podcast, we also talk about people's journeys and careers. You're trained as a lawyer.
And, yes.
And you've just written a book on regret. Once again, I was just curious, if you really, before we dive into the book, Dan, if it's okay with you, I'd love to know,
sure,
are there one or two big pivotal choices you made that have got you to where you are now after a degree in law?
I think that the two pivotal choices were going to work, becoming self-employed. I think that was a really important moment. That was about 25 years ago now, amazingly, where I'd been working in some political jobs here in the United States. I became, through no fault of my own and without any planning, a political speechwriter. And I realized that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life at all. I didn't want to do it rest of my 30s. And what I really wanted to do was go work for myself. And I think that was pivotal. And then a few years before that, I think that marrying my wife was pivotal. Those are the two of the most pivotal decisions that I made.
And if I may persist for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, persist.
In what ways did your marriage shape your career in the context of where you are now? I'm curious.
For a whole host of reasons, because, you know, when you work for, so ultimately what happened is that Jessica was working as a lawyer and then we had a kid, and then I went up to work on for myself, and she kept her job and she kept her health insurance because we needed to, support ourselves. And that went on for a while. And then when I began to establish my footing, she left her job, and we ended up essentially working together for the last 20 years or so. And so that was really essential. The other thing is that, you know, when you work the way that I do, there's a very porous border between work and family. And so if on the other side of that porous border is not support and love and empathy and intelligence, it becomes very, very hard.
I love the point Dan makes about a porous border between work and home. I guess even people who worked in corporations experienced it, given the work from home context in COVID. Having made the shift to becoming an independent consultant about 6 years back, I couldn't agree more about the role that a spouse plays in navigating the vagaries of their journey. Dan also speaks about how his wife provided a bit of a buffer that gave him the ability to take the plunge. A related point came up in my conversation with Jennifer Petriglieri of INSEAD, the author of the book Couples That Work, who was in the podcast to discuss about how dual career couples navigate key transitions in their life.
So the couples who do very well, I found, are those who flick their model of support from that to a model of support called a secure base. Now, a secure base means three things. First, it means, of course, there is that level of comfort, that level of support, but layered on top of that are another two things. One is if I can think of it as a loving kick kick away from the relationship. So a loving push away to say, you know, I'll be here to dust you off, but you get out there and figure it out. So if you're unsure, if you're having these existential questions, the response is, don't worry, we'll be fine. It's okay, get out there then and figure something out. So it's this push to explore, a push away from the safety of the relationship, away from the comfort zone and into that learning zone, that risk zone. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a bit counterintuitive because in a relationship, when our partner's feeling a little bit uncertain and a little bit wobbly, our natural instinct, just like that with our children, is to hold them close, is to give them a cuddle, you know, metaphorically and really. And this is quite the opposite. When we see our partner struggling with something, feeling a little unsure, instead of pulling them close, we actually push them away in a loving way. And so it's quite a different model of support.
Jennifer speaks about three transitions that all couples go through and speaks about how they could navigate those. Do look up that conversation if this topic is of interest. Thank you for listening. For more, please visit playtopotential.com.